This is Talking Dementia with Remo Health. I'm your host, Dr. Emily Silverman. Join us as we explore the latest advancements, insights, and strategies that help empower those living with dementia and the families that support them. Each episode, we speak with leading experts, from physicians and researchers to policymakers and clinicians, to provide you with the resources needed to navigate this complex disease. Today, we're speaking with Dr. Armin Mugamian. Armin is a neurologist and the medical director of the Ray Dolby Brain Health Center at the California Pacific Medical Center in San Francisco and leads a multidisciplinary team of doctors, nurse practitioners, neuropsychologists, and social workers in the treatment of patients with cognitive impairment. He also heads the clinical trials program at Dolby with a specific focus on Alzheimer's. Armin went to undergrad at UC Berkeley, got an MD-PhD at Penn, and did his neurology residency and fellowship at UCSF. Armin, thank you so much for joining us.
No, thanks for having me.
Armin, it's so good to see you today. To begin, can you tell us about your journey to neurology?
I've always been fascinated as a kid by the brain. I wish I had a really good explanation for it, but I don't really have a great one. I'm left-handed, and I always was interested in why I was left-handed. I felt a little different, and I was intrigued by why I was left-handed. I remember being in elementary school and not being able to cut a piece of paper with right-handed scissors with my left hand, and it was always interesting. And I think that the brain is fascinating as a human organ. It is the organ that makes people who they are. Mice have a brain, but it's a different brain. And they have a heart, but it's a very similar heart. It's a very similar gut, but the brain is really what makes humans human. And I was just fascinated by that. At Berkeley, I did an undergrad training in molecular biology with an emphasis in neuroscience. I got really interested in research, and that's why I did an MD and a PhD. And so my PhD was focused in understanding why cells degenerate in neurodegenerative diseases, like what makes them die, one potential mechanism of things not moving well in cells. And so I was just fascinated with how cells of the brain may degenerate. And then I went back and completed medical school, and it just really fit well to go into neurology. I was fascinated with how the brain works, and I was really interested in medicine, and neurology is medicine for the brain. And so that was a really easy fit for me. Then I came to UCSF, where I did my neurology residency, and originally actually went back to the lab to do science and initiated a project to build on my PhD work and understanding what makes neurons degenerate. But I also really enjoyed seeing patients and felt the pull to do more clinical work. And so I left UCSF after my training and joined the Dolby Brain Health Center in 2020, right before the pandemic, to be able to build a clinic that is focused purely on treating patients with cognitive impairment, different neurodegenerative diseases that affect cognition. And it's been an amazing experience to be able to build a clinic that's focused on treating patients as well as their family members and helping them adjust around a disease and find the best path forward and improve their quality of life. Part of that is still doing research, but really research is much more focused on early access to treatments, better diagnostics. So we do clinical trials that are treatment trials or better diagnostic trials to improve diagnosis in patients sooner and sooner.
Talk about the difference between working at UCSF, which is a very basic science-oriented research institution, and CPMC, which is, my understanding, is more focused on care delivery and clinical aspects of neurology. What was it like to transition from one environment to the other?
Initially, it was terrifying. When I left, all I knew was academic medicine, but the transition has been phenomenal. So I work for Sutter Health, which is a large healthcare system that spans from above Sacramento to as low as Santa Cruz, even further south than that. And I saw a great opportunity in being able to provide tertiary care in a large healthcare system. I saw that cognitive impairment was moving closer towards treatments that can change outcomes, so a disease-modifying therapy. And I saw a great need and opportunity to be able to build a tertiary clinic in a large healthcare system to deliver improved cognitive care to patients. The terrifying part is the unknown. But I've had an amazing experience because my clinic exists for one reason, which is to treat patients, full stop. I exist to treat patients, to evaluate them and help them adjust around this disease. And I say patients, but when I say patients, I actually mean patients and families, because the unique aspect of cognitive impairment is that I think we have to define why it's even important to consider cognitive impairment as a disease or why it's important to diagnose it. So at the simplest level, as patients have changes in cognition, cognition is memory, often short-term memory, it's executive function. So things like your ability to multitask, your ability to pay attention, your ability to focus, it's visual perceptual abilities. So your ability to navigate your environment, it's language, your ability to communicate, receive language, produce language, come up with words. I mean, all of that is cognition, and different diseases of the brain affect different areas of the brain that can involve different aspects of cognition. And so there's many different neurodegenerative disorders that we talk about. But back to my point about cognitive impairment. So as patients' cognition declines, it can impact their function. And so someone has to take over that function. That is usually the family. It's a friend. It is a loved one. It's a spouse. It's a child. And so the really unique aspect of cognitive care is that you are seeing a patient in front of you, but you're absolutely managing the care of that patient in consultation with help from somebody else that's taking over that function. Dementia is defined by a cognitive impairment that results in a functional impairment, and somebody has to take over that function. So we are treating two people. Every patient in a cognitive clinic is two patients, the patient in front of you and whoever's helping them out if they've reached to the point of dementia. And so I exist for treating all of those people. And we've been very, very lucky to have philanthropic backing that has allowed us to have this multidisciplinary approach to treating patients. And I think that is incredibly important. It's not just about a doctor. It's about a doctor and a staff. We use social workers, but you could use other providers as well. I think social workers provide a really unique training, and they bring a lot of unique skills to helping families adjust around this and a lot of the psychosocial dynamic changes that happen as patients' cognition changes.
You talked about how in dementia, there's the person with the disease, but then there's automatically at least one other person involved because somebody needs to be helping the patient with their function. Tell us about what you're building at CPMC or what is already built there in terms of innovating on the care delivery model for dementia, because we know that we have a long way to go in serving these patients adequately. And I know that you have thought a lot about the right way to deliver care. I'm just wondering if you could speak to that model and what you're working on.
I certainly don't know if I have the right answer. I don't think there is a right answer. I think that actually applies to a lot of aspects of care of people with cognitive impairment. There isn't the right way to do that. There's just the way forward. What we've done at the Dolby Brain Health Center is if they're a dyad, we're a dyad. So they come in, patient and family. So every family from the first visit meets with the social worker. The initial intake, it's a lot of additional history that's obtained from the family. Family, again, meaning loved one. There's other words that you could use, but it doesn't have to be somebody that's actually related. It just has to be somebody that knows the patient well, that cares about the patient. So our initial evaluation is the social worker meeting with this loved one to obtain additional history, things they might not want to talk about in front of the patient, and getting a real grasp of what they are seeing in the person that we're going to be evaluating. I think it provides a wealth of information about behavioral and functional changes. Diseases of the brain are different than diseases of other parts of the body. So if you have a heart problem, your brain senses your heart and then can report on what's going on. But in a cognitive impairment, the organ that's involved in the disease is the same organ that's involved in reporting. So there can be a conflict of interest, and it can go in any direction. Sometimes patients report more symptoms than family sees. Sometimes they're totally congruent, and sometimes the family sees so much more than the patient does. And that's part of the disease that has medical terms for it. But it's incredibly important to get that outsider's perspective because of this conflict of interest in the organ that's involved in the disease, the organ that's reporting what's going on. So to get back onto the point of how we deliver care, a patient is referred in, family member, loved one meets with a social worker, gets a history, assesses standardized evaluations of history, function, behavioral changes. It establishes a relationship because these are longitudinal diseases that we treat. And so it's not just about treatment and diagnosis, but it's about longitudinal management. Caring for somebody with cognitive impairment, this isn't a one and done evaluation. This is walking with somebody through a process, which is chronic disease management. So initial evaluation with a social worker done with the family, then a provider, myself, or a nurse practitioner will go in, meet with the family and the patient together. While that family member is meeting with the social worker, we're often doing some cognitive testing to get an idea of objective measures of cognitive change on standardized evaluations. Then we bring everybody back together. Sometimes we'll review what has already been talked about with the social worker. If there's sensitive issues, we may not get the patient's perspective on what's going on, talk about the cognitive testing, and then develop a plan to figure out what's going on.
Many types of dementia have no cure. Alzheimer's, for example, but there are others. So a patient might ask, if there's no cure, if there's nothing that can be done about this, why does it even matter that I get a diagnosis?
To answer that question, I think we need to first define what dementia is, and then the answer becomes evident. Dementia is a stage of cognitive impairment. The most simple definition, it means there is a change in cognitive function, which has now impacted the patient's ability to function in life. So they were doing something, and now they cannot do something. There are many different causes of dementia. You could have dementia because you have Alzheimer's disease. You could have dementia because you have Parkinson's disease. You had a traumatic brain injury, multiple sclerosis. Anything that causes brain injury can cause dementia. Alzheimer's disease happens to be the most common cause of dementia, but it's not the only cause. And so again, dementia is a change in cognition which impacts somebody's function. Prior to the diagnosis of dementia, patients have a diagnosis of a mild cognitive impairment. So that is a cognitive change that patients are adapting around. There's no functional impairment. They may be more reliant on a list. They may be more reliant on calendars and reminders, but they're adapting around it. They're managing their medications. They're managing their finances. They're managing their calendar and their life. So when we talk about diagnosing cognitive impairment, if you diagnose it early before there's a functional impairment, you can create awareness around the risk of progressing to a dementia. Maybe you can find causes that may be reversible or slow the progression down. But most importantly, you've created awareness and maybe a safety plan to prevent the functional declines. If you've waited until somebody has dementia, then you've basically waited till a mistake has happened. They've mismanaged their medications. They end up in the hospital because they forgot to take their blood pressure medicines and their blood pressure was too high. They had a stroke, maybe. Or they got scammed by someone and lost a lot of money. That's a terrible thing that happens to too many people because of cognitive impairment. And I'm not going to say that diagnosing prevents everything bad from happening, but I think a lot of mistakes are allowed to happen because there's a lack of awareness around cognitive change. And so a lot of what we do is put a name to it. We put a disease process to it and give the family and loved ones permission to be able to help the patient. We optimize and value independence and autonomy, but we also have to realize that as cognition changes, it can impact function. And so we need to create a safety plan that allows patients to be as autonomous as possible, but also safe. So to get back to your question about why does diagnosis matter? I mean, I think diagnosis, early diagnosis in particular, can be preventative. We can try to create systems to keep patients safe and prevent them from having more problems from their cognitive impairment than necessary. And you're right. We cannot cure Alzheimer's disease. But just because you can't cure it doesn't mean you can't manage it. And that's the difference. And so, as I said before, management of dementia and cognitive impairment is walking with somebody through a process and helping them understand what symptoms are appropriate for the disease state. How do you manage those symptoms? not everything needs to be focused on a cure. Not everything needs to be focused on medications that can be given to somebody to fix a problem. And often what we do, particularly in chronic disease management, is help people through the process and limit additional problems that can arise from this medical problem. That goes for dementia, that goes for high blood pressure, that goes for diabetes, that goes through all sorts of disease management. For reasons that I can't really explain, people think of cognition as different and there's this apathy, this, why does it matter? But I think when you start to break it down into these components of what cognitive impairment means to people and their lives and their function, the answer becomes evident that understanding what the future can hold and creating a safety plan, I think, is incredibly important and valuable for patients and their families.
What is the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's?
Dementia is a stage of cognitive impairment. All that dementia means is that there is a cognitive change that has now impacted somebody's function. They need help with medications, finances, maybe they shouldn't drive anymore, they need help with management of their calendar and their affairs. Before you get to a dementia, you get to a mild cognitive impairment, and that's where you are adapting around the cognitive change. Within dementia, there's stages itself. So mild dementia is when patients need help with what we call instrumental activities of daily living, the things I listed before. It's management of finances and driving, management of their medications. When you get into moderate and severe stage, it's increasing needs for help with ADLs, activities of daily living. This is bathing, dressing, going to the bathroom, grooming. So moderate stage is when you start to prompt patients for that. Severe stage is when somebody's fully dependent. The staging of dementia is incredibly important because it tells you the level of care that a patient will need. If somebody has a mild dementia, they can probably live alone. They just need somebody helping them with those activities. If you're in moderate and severe stage, you're really going to need daily care because those are daily needs. You could have a dementia because you have a variety of different brain injuries. So it could be Alzheimer's disease, which I'll talk about in a minute, but it could be you had a traumatic brain injury, you had a stroke. Dementia, again, is just a cognitive impairment that results in a functional decline. Alzheimer's disease accounts for about 60 to 80% of dementias, and it is due to a pathology in the brain. So Alzheimer's disease is an accumulation of abnormal proteins in the brain. There's two that accumulate. One is called amyloid and one is called tau. And these accumulate progressively over a number of years and cause dementia. So if somebody, for example, a 70-year-old comes to my clinic and they say, look, I have a short-term memory problem. And the wife is saying, well, now I've had to take over management of his medications and took over getting the tax papers ready. I do an evaluation. That person's diagnosis is a mild dementia stage due to Alzheimer's disease. Like in many other diseases, we have a stage and a cause, similar to cancer, right? You don't just say, I have cancer. You say, I have breast cancer of a certain stage. So it's very similar in cognitive care. You have the stage of the cognitive impairment and then the cause of the cognitive impairment, but they're distinct.
Tell us about the process of getting to diagnosis. Can this be simple and straightforward? Can this be complex and needing to unfold over a long period of time with serial testing? What are the ingredients that you use to make a diagnosis? We know we have imaging, we have blood tests, we have quizzes that we give people. Bring us into the diagnostic process. What can people expect and what is it like on your end examining all the data and trying to arrive at an answer?
When you talk about the diagnosis of cognitive impairment, there's the deluxe ultra package of all the things that we can do to figure it out. And then there's very simple tools that primary care can use. And this part of my answer is really geared towards other physicians and primary care doctors is that this is something that primary care can do. And depending on what the patient's needs are, then you can think about how much of that workup you want to do. In primary care, if a patient says, I think my memory is not great, I think you start up by saying, I think it's really important you brought this up. And why don't we schedule a visit to talk about that and bring somebody with you? Point of that is to get additional information to talk about it. So at the simplest level, it's getting the symptoms, what they're worried about, getting somebody else to inform on how it's going that can understand, are there functional impacts? Again, you really want to understand cognition because you want to understand the impact that the cognitive impairment can have on somebody's life and quality of life. If you make a mistake in your finances, you can lose a lot of money that you wouldn't be able to provide care for yourself in the future, et cetera. So at the simplest level, it's understanding the symptoms. It's getting information about their function. It's reviewing their medications to make sure that they don't have medications on that could be sedating. They're not taking Tylenol PM, et cetera. There's a series of medications that are well known to worsen cognitive function, particularly in older adults. I would really encourage primary care doctors to review those things. If you do that and the patient is not satisfied, they want to try to keep understanding this more, then the first step to understanding somebody's cognitive impairment is to establish the severity of that cognitive impairment. And that's why we use these standardized evaluations that measure cognitive function. It gives us an objective measure of cognitive function compared to standard people that have taken the test. And those can be super simple tests, like remember three words and draw a clock, to a full day evaluation of cognitive function. That's a full neuropsychological evaluation. And the need for that level of cognitive investigation, let's call it, depends on the needs of the patient and the severity of the cognitive impairment. You want to establish the severity. If you can't draw a clock, you're not going to tolerate hours and hours of testing, and there's probably not a need for it. When you're evaluating cognition, there's going to be some level of objective cognitive decline, and there's going to be a structural exam. So there's function and structure. Again, like with many things with medicine, that's what we evaluate. So the structural test is typically an MRI. That's really become the standard, which gives us a landscape of the brain. It's the blueprint. What does the brain look like? Majority of the time, we're making sure that there's no surprises, no tumors, no strokes, things that may account for the cognitive impairment. We also get a nice understanding of what parts of the brain look bigger than others. And this may or may not be reported out, but you get an idea. Is there certain parts of the brain that are smaller than others that would suggest an etiology of the area of the brain that's involved? And then you put all this together. So it's getting a history. What are the symptoms? Is it language? Is it memory? Is it executive function? And then you map that on with objective measures of those areas. And then you map that onto structure. So it's symptoms, objective changes in cognition and structure. And then that gives us an idea of what parts of the brain are involved and does it all fit together and the severity of that cognitive impairment and the severity of impact on their function. After that, depending on different severities of cognitive impairment, one of the biggest advances that we've had, particularly in the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, we now have tools to be able to diagnose Alzheimer's disease in a living person. So 40 years ago, if it looked like Alzheimer's disease, it probably was Alzheimer's disease. You have a short-term memory problem, probably Alzheimer's disease. What we call a diagnosis of exclusion, meaning, well, it's not other things, so it's probably Alzheimer's disease. Now in the past 10 to 15 years, we have these tests that have turned Alzheimer's disease from a diagnosis of exclusion to a diagnosis of inclusion. I can measure the level of those abnormal proteins in your brain through a variety of different measures. Probably the best ones that are established are spinal fluid, a test called an amyloid PET scan, which is an imaging way to measure those abnormal proteins. Likely in the next couple of years, we're going to get better blood tests for doing that, which would make it even easier to make this a diagnosis of inclusion. But it's important to note that just because you don't have Alzheimer's disease doesn't mean you don't have a cognitive impairment. So this again gets back to the point that you really need to distinguish between the stage of cognitive impairment and the cause. And the stage of cognitive impairment is purely based on the level of functional change, and anybody can do that. Any primary care doctor can assess the level of impact that it's having on the patient. And I think that that is the most important thing, because that's going to get people to create awareness around safety factors of how this impairment is affecting their life. And then we go through that. And as you alluded to, sometimes we do all of that and we still don't know what's going on. And then it's the test of time. So this is a journey, and sometimes we can't figure it out initially. We have to watch it evolve as the patient evolves. And hopefully it doesn't evolve and we couldn't figure it out because maybe it wasn't a progressive etiology, which is great. But sometimes it evolves in front of us and we figure it out over time.
So let's say I'm a patient. I'm having symptoms. I come into your clinic. you take a history, you do a physical exam, you get an MRI of my brain, you maybe do a spinal tap to test my spinal fluid, you collect blood to look at markers in the blood. What about the quizzing? I know that there's something called neuropsych testing, where you get all sorts of questions and almost like games. What can a patient expect? And what is the purpose of those quizzes? And what kind of information does that give you?
Neuropsych testing, cognitive testing, it's the same thing. And it can go from what we call screening exams, which are standardized tests that are packaged together. That's something that is as simple as the mini-cog, which is a clock and three words that people remember, to a little more complex tests like the Montreal Cognitive Assessment, that's called the MoCA for short, or the mini mental status exam. It's been around for a while. Those are one page, two page kind of tests that are maybe 15 minutes. And then the most in-depth evaluation would be a full neuropsychological evaluation, which is given by PhD trained psychologists that have subspecialty training in neuropsychology. And neuropsychology sounds like a big word, but it's basically they're trained in the development and delivery of these tests, and most importantly, the analysis of these tests. And what all of these tests are doing are trying to ask a few different questions. One, is there evidence of objective declines in cognition? Objective meaning, are you below where we would expect you to be on a formalized exam? And that's very important. If somebody comes in to a cardiology clinic, you do the similar idea. You do an EKG, which tells you, is the rhythm of the heart working? You do an echocardiogram, is the structure of the heart pumping in the way that it should? So we do the same idea, structure and function. And the cognitive testing is the function of the brain. It establishes the severity of the cognitive impairment on objective measures. Now, there is a correlation between the severity of the cognitive impairment and the severity of what we see on the cognitive testing, but it's not one-to-one. So I can't say that somebody that has a MoCA score of 20 is going to have this level of function, or a mild cognitive impairment or mild dementia. They tend to correlate, but they're not one-to-one. But it's what tells you the severity of the cognitive impairment. And then it starts to get at the pattern of cognitive changes, because the brain is modular. Different parts of the brain do different things, and different diseases of the brain affect different areas. Cognition just doesn't across the board sync. So patients may have a memory problem. So we have to test short-term memory, but there are many things that they're still able to do normally. And so the cognitive testing tells you the severity, but it also tells you the pattern. And that pattern is so helpful in understanding the cause of their cognitive impairment. It's harder in the earlier stages. So that's why we tend to focus on more cognitive testing in patients that have less impairment, because there's more to dig through and figure out what parts are working and what parts aren't working. As diseases of the brain that get worse over time get worse, cognition starts to get more and more impaired. So you need less testing to figure out what's going on. But in those early stages is where long cognitive testing is very helpful to establish the severity of the cognitive impairment and the pattern of the cognitive impairment to get us to understand the cause of what's going on.
So I go through a battery of tests, and now you have all the information. And let's say you have a diagnosis now. You've used all of this information to come up with a working hypothesis about what might be wrong with me as a patient. You have a very direct and straightforward communication style, which I think is really valuable. How do you lay down this diagnosis with patients and families? Do you just give them the diagnosis and let them react? Do you give them the diagnosis and then launch into what to expect? What words do you use? What scripts do you use? Can you bring us into that moment of, Mrs. Smith, you have X?
It's all done in stages. At the first visit, you come in, we do a bunch of history, maybe we do some cognitive testing, probably have an MRI at that first visit. And I say, look, you have a mild cognitive impairment. You have symptoms of cognitive change, which you're adapting around. Now we need to figure out why. You have a short-term memory problem. you're repeating yourself, maybe misplacing items in the house. This is concerning for early Alzheimer's disease. Doesn't mean that it is, but there's enough concern here that we should do this test. So that, I think, is scary to people, but most people that come into my clinic are already thinking it. So I'm not telling them anything they haven't thought of. I'm just putting it out on the table. Then they may get that confirmatory test, and then they come back and we talk about that. And often the way that I do it is I always recap. So you're here because of these symptoms. We've done this so far. And now we had the question of whether or not this is Alzheimer's disease. And so you did an amyloid PET scan to measure amyloid in your brain to figure out if you had a mild cognitive impairment due to Alzheimer's disease. And then I tell them, this is positive or this is negative. So if it's positive, the first thing I talk about is, what does that mean? Everybody that hears the word Alzheimer's disease gets terrified because they think of severe dementia due to Alzheimer's disease. And if the system is going right, hopefully we're not diagnosing somebody at the severe stages, but we're diagnosing them at an early stage, which is typically defined as mild cognitive impairment or mild dementia. They were the same person that they were before I gave them the diagnosis. They just now know why it happened. So we need to break down their fears about Alzheimer's disease. By the time somebody has come to me, they probably had cognitive symptoms for a couple of years. And the abnormal proteins in the brain have probably been accumulating for a decade. I tell people that not to scare them, but to put it into the context of what this disease means. It is a disease that will impact them. I'm not trying to sugarcoat it. They have changed. But I always say that this is a slowly progressive process. This is not day over day or month over month. This is a year on year process. And the goal from here forward is to find ways to improve their quality of life. And there are ways to do that, right? I'm not just saying that. We can improve patients' quality of life and try to optimize their quality of life to limit the impact of this disease on them. So you get that diagnosis, and then everybody sort of goes through, you know, they get sad, they get depressed. That lasts for a couple of weeks, maybe a couple of months. And then they realize 3, 6 months, 12 months later, yeah, things have changed a little bit, but you know what? It's not major changes. So Alzheimer's is a very slowly progressive process. So getting back to that patient that I've just diagnosed, you talk about where this is going. And the important point about some of these tests that prove that people have Alzheimer's disease, they tend to not give us any information about the rate of change. They just tell us that this is Alzheimer's disease and you will decline over time. But I don't have any great ways to say, all right, in 2 years, you're going to need help with medicines. And in 5 years, you need help getting dressed. I can't tell you that. We talk also about non-medicine ways to optimize brain function and build resilience to the disease. And these are a lot of factors that people already know about. A lot of them have to do with what we call vascular risk factors. So diseases of the blood vessels, high blood pressure, diabetes. We talk about what they can do to eat a healthy diet. We talk about building routine. Building routine is incredibly important for patients with cognitive impairment. It helps address their anxieties they may happen to have. It also helps them optimize their function. It keeps them in the community, keeps them doing the things that they enjoy doing. So building a good brain healthy routine is incredibly important for patients. It involves some level of physical activity, about 150 minutes a week. It involves social engagement with their friends. It involves cognitively stimulating activities. And these are incredibly important to building resilience to the disease. So we talk about those things. And then we do talk about treatments. There are some medicines that have been around for about 30 years. Basically, they increase a chemical in the brain that helps to boost memory and attention a little bit, optimizes brain chemistry. It doesn't change the trajectory of the disease. It's still a process downward, but it boosts them upward a little bit. So you can imagine a curve kind of sloping downward. It doesn't change the slope, but it changes the y-axis. So now they're at a little bit higher spot. And particularly, I think in earlier stage disease, patients can notice some symptomatic improvement. And now one of the biggest advances in Alzheimer's disease in the past year has been the advent of disease-modifying therapies. When we use the word disease-modifying, that means we're changing the slope. These medicines are the first medicines that actually slow the rate of decline. They don't cure the disease. They don't even stop progression, but they slow it down, particularly for early stage patients. These can keep people at an earlier stage longer, keeping people with less cognitive and functional declines. And so that's been something that has been developed past year and is providing some optimism for patients.
So the example you just gave is for a patient and a family receiving a diagnosis of Alzheimer's, which you said is a slowly progressing type of dementia. But there's a lot of different arcs here, depending on the diagnosis. The arc for Alzheimer's may be different from the arc for dementia with Lewy bodies, which may be different from the arc for frontotemporal dementia. How do you think about these arcs? And do you come in with scripts for each arc, or how are you thinking about that?
I typically avoid giving people too much specifics because I don't think we're very good at giving them prognosis as far as like, you have 4 years, you have 8 years. Sure, on average, maybe. But there are many things that go into those prognoses and they hold up on average, but at the individual patient, they break down dramatically. Everybody wants that number, but I rarely give people concrete numbers. I just don't think it's the right thing to do because I don't think it's accurate. I can be wrong both ways. And if I'm right, it's just lucky. So I don't do that as far as like you have X number of years. I do talk about the manifestations of the disease and how those manifestations can impact people. So certainly in Lewy body disease, for example. So Lewy body is on the Parkinson spectrum. These patients have cognitive impairment. They often have visual hallucinations and they develop Parkinsonism. So they look like they have Parkinson's disease. Typically, it's not as tremor. They just move a little slower. And so it's important for them to know about motor changes. And motor changes are an area that can really affect people because people fall, they injure themselves, they have more needs. And I think that is one aspect of Lewy body that does make it a harder, I hate using the word harder or less hard, but it's an aspect that needs to be addressed by patients and families, and it can make it a more challenging disease to treat. We do have medicines that can address some of that Parkinsonism. So I try to focus on the symptoms, and in behavioral variant frontotemporal dementia, they have a lot of behavioral abnormalities, and so they act differently, and it's important for patients and families to explain those behaviors. It doesn't mean you have to treat them with medicines, but a lot of it is just in understanding what's going on, understanding the tendencies of that patient to maybe act erratically and do something odd, and putting them in situations that set them up for success instead of setting them up for failure. So I do shy away from prognosis because we're just not great at it, and focus on what we can do to manage it and find the path forward. Because any of these diseases, you still can find quality of life and make adjustments to improve both the patient and the family's quality of life despite these diseases.
What are some of the most common questions or concerns that you hear patients and families ask?
Certainly, one of the most common questions is the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's disease. Probably the biggest fear of patients and families is, when are they not going to recognize me? And I think that's what most people fear. Again, this fear of severe Alzheimer's disease. And I can't answer that question for people. And sometimes it never happened. So those are probably two of the most common questions that people ask me. I think another one that people fear is, what does this mean for my life as far as, can I drive or can I manage my medications? How is this going to impact me? And that is a really complex question, and it often is patient by patient depending on the stage of cognitive impairment. So we address all of those issues. My goal is not to take someone's driver's license away unless it has to be that way. We're always going to be optimizing a patient's independence, but recognizing the potential for a safety problem that can impact their quality of life or the quality of life of other people, especially with the driving issue. So that guidance, everybody wants to know what the future holds, and we don't have those tools, but we certainly walk with people through this process and figure it out together.
I love what you're saying about uncertainty and how you can't give people a number. You have 4 years to live. You have 15 years to live. And how you also can't answer questions like, when will my loved one stop recognizing me? Because we don't know. There's so much we don't know. And as you said, even the data is focused on averages, and those averages break down when you're looking at an individual person. And yet, it's also important not to tiptoe around these issues and to be able to say the word dementia, to be able to say the word Alzheimer's. Can you speak to that? Just the importance of really communicating clearly and directly about these diseases.
The fear comes from a misunderstanding of the disease. The fear of Alzheimer's disease comes from people equating Alzheimer's disease as severe dementia. So another question that always comes up is, should I tell my family? I'll get back to that, but I think it's important to note. So if you have mild cognitive impairment due to Alzheimer's disease, often people don't look that different. It's only the family member that knows what's going on. And so we need to define these terms properly. And I think there's a lack of education in the public. I think there's a lack of education in doctors. We could do a poll of graduating medical students from our crosstown institution at UCSF. I guarantee you that the majority of medical students do not know what dementia is. They would give you some number on a cognitive test, or they'd give you some convoluted answer, but they're not going to be able to define it. So that's a problem. I would even argue that graduating neurology residents don't know how to properly define dementia, and they should be the experts. So we need to define these terms for people. We need to talk about the arc of the disease, which is a slowly progressive disease, and call it out. Everyone fears cancer too, but people say, I have breast cancer. They caught it early, and I'm going to do something about it. And I think that's where we need to turn the table on Alzheimer's disease. It starts by calling out what it is, defining the terms mild cognitive impairment, mild dementia, moderate dementia due to Alzheimer's disease. And Alzheimer's disease is a process. It's a long disease arc, and you can live in the community. You can act normally with a mild memory problem to that severe dementia stage. And those that get diagnosed early, I encourage them to tell people. Typically, you start with your closest friends and then spread it outward. And the reason I encourage them to tell people is that you are changing the narrative of what this disease means. You are changing the narrative towards you can be a person with a little bit of memory problem that needs someone to manage their medications, but you're still the great person that you were. You have Alzheimer's disease. You have a short-term memory. You may not remember the conversation we're having right now, but you're still who you are. If you tiptoe around it, we're never going to get to people coming in for earlier diagnosis because they all fear the disease. You're never going to get people understanding what this disease really means. And we're moving towards an earlier and earlier diagnosis. And that's important for, as I said before, around safety, but also around treatment. If you look at medicine in general, we are really bad at fixing problems at the end of the process. So we're really bad at curing metastatic cancer. We are really bad at curing AIDS. We're pretty good now at treating people that have stage 1 cancer, stage 0 cancer that's noticed on a mammogram. We're really good at treating HIV virus that causes AIDS. So we better move at these markers of disease and treat these earlier and earlier diseases. And that starts by calling the disease for what it is and educating people and creating an awareness about what this disease actually means and destigmatizing it so that we can get people in earlier and earlier. Another term for dementia is brain failure. The brain is now no longer able to do something it was doing before. You could call dementia brain failure. Now, if you conceptualize that, it makes people a little scared, but it's true. It's not doing what it used to do. And so we should get people before they have failure. We should diagnose them with the earliest stages of the disease. And it starts by creating an awareness of what this disease means and just calling it out for what it is, and also telling people it's going to be okay. I think doctors shy away from that, but it is going to be okay. We're going to figure this out together. I may not fix it. I'm not going to fix it, but I'm here. I have experience with this. My team has experience with this. We're going to walk with you through this. We're going to focus on the quality of life that matters. We're going to find a way to make this better, and it's going to be okay.
I want to end on a note of hope. What's the future of treatment? We don't have a cure. We may. So what do you see coming down the pike in the next 5, 10, 20, 50 years?
I think cure is pretty tough. I'll start with the hard part and then I'll go to the hope. I think when we talk about cure, that might not happen in my lifetime. But I think the goal in treatment of Alzheimer's disease and dementia is going to be to stop progression or delay the onset. And I think we're getting pretty close to that. The first disease-modifying therapy was just approved in July of 2023. And that was studied in an early-stage disease and showed a modest slowing of cognitive decline over time, about 30% on a variety of different measures. They have side effects and issues that we need to talk about. But what I'm most excited about with these medicines is the next stage trials, which are looking at patients that have the pathology of the disease that don't have symptoms yet, because successes in medicine come from prevention. And what we're doing, and the Dolby Center is involved in one of these trials, is finding these patients and giving them these medicines before they develop the cognitive impairment and seeing if we can delay the onset of their cognitive impairment. And the reason I'm excited about these trials is that if you looked at the treatment trials that have already been completed, when we look at the patients that have the earliest stage of disease, they have the greatest benefit. And so we're just going to move that needle earlier and earlier to try to figure out who needs to be treated. But I think getting early treatment is more likely to have benefit at slowing the progression or delaying the progression of this disease, delaying the onset of Alzheimer's disease. And then what's next going to happen is combination treatments. So like in many aspects of medicine, I used cancer and HIV, but because I think those are great examples. We had one medicine for HIV, the first medicine, AZT, it was okay. But that also paved the way for the next set of therapies. And now the standard of therapies are multiple therapy. You have a couple of often multi-drug cocktail that acts at different components of the HIV virus and propagation to reduce the viral load and prevent people from getting AIDS, which is the sequelae of HIV. Same thing with cancer, right? You don't just give a person one cancer treatment. You give them multiple different drugs that attack different components of the cancer. So the future in treatment of Alzheimer's disease is going to be early treatment, which requires early diagnosis, and eventually multimodal treatment, meaning multiple different drugs attacking different aspects of the disease. Because it's naive to think that Alzheimer's disease is caused by one problem. It's multiple issues, and so we need multiple medicines to address those different issues. And then I think the other issue that we haven't really talked about today, but I think is very important, is what the family can do that is not medicines to treat the manifestations of the disease. I alluded to this a little bit before around creating a routine for patients, optimizing brain health, but the family and the environment that the patient is in can have a dramatic impact on the manifestations of the disease. This isn't always just about finding medications to address different problems, but really trying to find ways to reduce anxiety using non-medicine ways. And that's incredibly important for patients. And often anxiety or depression or irritability can be addressed without always using medications.
How do you counsel patients on some of these newer cutting-edge therapies that are coming out, like, for example, the anti-amyloid therapies?
As we've been talking about, there are these new therapies that are disease-modifying, meaning they slow the progression of Alzheimer's disease down. And these are specific for Alzheimer's. The medicines remove amyloid from the brain, which is one of the causal factors that drives Alzheimer's disease. These medicines don't cure the disease. They don't even stop progression. They slow it down by about 30% at 18 months. which is how long the trial was done. The issue with these medicines is that they're complex. It's not a pill. It's an infusion. And it's frequent. The one that was recently approved is called lecanemab, goes by the brand name of Leqembi, and that's every 2 weeks for about 18 months. So you're talking about 36 infusions. It has some side effects, one of which can be the side effect called ARIA, which stands for amyloid-related imaging abnormalities, that as this medicine removes amyloid from the brain, it can stimulate the immune system, which leads to inflammation in the brain, and sometimes that leads to bleeding or hemorrhage. About 75% of patients that get it are asymptomatic, but it's still a side effect. And there were 3 patients that died due to the severity of that side effect in the trial. There were 1,800 total. So incredibly impactful for those 3 patients, but fairly low risk on average. So with these new therapies, my goal is not to get patients on to the therapy. My goal is for patients to make the choice for what is right for them. What's involved in making that choice is health systems and physicians offering it to patients, but more importantly, patients coming in an early stage disease. Early stage Alzheimer's disease is defined by a mild cognitive impairment, meaning symptoms of cognitive change that they're adapting around, or early stages of mild dementia, meaning that it's now impacting their ability to manage some of their medications or finances. And in all of these cases, if patients are eligible for lecanemab, they would have to get proven that they have Alzheimer's disease, meaning that they have that amyloid pathology in their brain. So we want to be able to get patients in for early diagnosis so that they are eligible for these therapies so that they can make the choice for themselves. And if you don't want to go through the rigmarole of the infusions, you're afraid of side effects, that's totally fine. But it's incredibly important that patients and families make the decision for themselves.
Armin, I just want to thank you so much for coming to speak with me today. You clearly have incredible clinical expertise in this topic, and it feels like a gift to be able to pick your brain, no pun intended, on dementia and Alzheimer's and diagnosis and treatment. And I'm just so grateful for you sitting down with me today. So thank you again.
Emily, it's been a total pleasure, and I'm happy to participate. And I think it's amazing what REMO is trying to do to improve detection and give families and patients resources to be able to find better quality of life despite cognitive changes.
I have been speaking with Dr. Armin Mughamian. Thank you so much again.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Talking Dementia with REMO Health. If you're looking for more information, resources, and expert insights, visit remo.health and subscribe so you never miss an episode. Until next time, take care.